Welcome. You are about to embark on a unique learning adventure from The Great Courses. Our courses are crafted to be entertaining journeys, both comprehensive and fascinating. They're designed to expand horizons, deepen understanding, and foster epiphanies in a broad array of subjects and university-level disciplines. The lecturers are university professors and subject matter experts carefully selected by The Great Courses and its customers for their intellectual distinction and exceptional abilities to teach. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalogs or visit our website at thegreatcourses.com and imagine how much you can learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the company of some of the greatest minds in the world. These lectures are titled, The Mysterious Etruscans. Your lecture is Dr. Stephen L. Tuck. Dr. Tuck is a professor of classics at Miami University. He received his PhD in classical art and archaeology from the University of Michigan. An esteemed teacher, Dr. Tuck received the 2014 Excellence in Undergraduate Teaching Award from the Archaeological Institute of America. He has conducted archaeological fieldwork and research in Italy, Greece, England, and Egypt, and has directed more than a dozen study tours in Italy. In addition to numerous articles in archaeological journals, Dr. Tuck is the author of A History of Roman Art, a lavishly illustrated introduction to the topic. Lecture 1. Between the Greeks and Romans.
I'm going to start this lecture by asking a favor of you. Here it is. Please trust me. Trust me that the material in this course is amazing and well worth your time as we explore it together. I know this is a hard sell for some. After all, there's a good reason we titled this Mysterious Etruscans. They're mysterious to us today. I know this because I've been asking people for a while what they know about the Etruscans. People sitting next to me on airplanes, in line at the hardware store, in the frozen food aisle. Lots of people. And the reaction is almost universally the same. People tell me they might have heard the name and that's it. Also, they generally move away slowly. But I believe in your intellectual curiosity and thirst for knowledge. And I believe that even if few people know much about the Etruscans, they'll give this a chance and come out of it glad you did. Well, thanks for being here and proving me right, at least on that first part. Well, you probably have a million questions about now. Why should we care about the Etruscans? Who were they? Where did they come from? Where did they live? Why aren't they here anymore? Why do they still matter? All good questions. Let's start to answer some of these. And when we're done, you'll understand why I love this material and think it's worth my time as well as yours. Let's start with a thought experiment. Consider what you know about the Romans. Specifically, ask yourself to list what constitutes some of the iconic elements of Roman culture. You might start with their cities. After all, Romans were great city builders, and many of their most famous urban centers are still inhabited today. Rome, Pompeii, Bologna, Siena, Florence, Orvieto, Capua. What if I told you that each one of these cities was Etruscan in its earliest days? That's right. It was the Etruscans who were the great and original city builders of ancient Italy. Well, what about other iconic objects or concepts that defined Roman society, such as the toga, the temple, the Roman house, religious rituals, such as the reading of the will of the gods from nature, burial practices, elite men defined by their service to the state, or gladiators. All of these were Etruscan as well. Other key parts of Roman culture, such as writing, art, and architecture, weren't invented by the Etruscans, but were transmitted to the Romans through the Etruscans, who added their own flourishes. If the Romans are, as I believe, one of the foundations of Western civilization, and even much of the world as we know it, then we need to acknowledge that many civilizing elements actually came from the Etruscans, who invented or transmitted them to Rome, and eventually to the world beyond. Let's take one example, and an obscure one, to make the point even clearer. The Etruscans originated the fasces. This is the bundle of rods and axes that was the symbol of political power in the state. The axe represented the power to force obedience to the law through capital punishment, while the bundle of rods represented the state's collective power. One thin stick can be broken by a man, but a bundle of sticks cannot. The Romans adopted the fasces and its image from the Etruscans, first for their kings as a sign of power, and then for their elected magistrates early in the Republic. It stayed with them until the fall of the Roman Empire. The symbol is found in heraldry and art in the Middle Ages, Renaissance, and early modern periods. Napoleon used it for the French Empire. It was adopted by Mussolini, and the name was applied to his political movement, fascism. The United States adopted it as well. It's on the wall flanking the speaker's platform in the House of Representatives chamber of the U.S. Capitol building, and it used to be on the reverse side of the dime. This one object symbolized the collective power of the state so simply and elegantly that it's still in use today, 2,500 years after its creation by the Etruscans. So, who were these people? Where did they live? Where did they come from? And how did these ideas of theirs spread? Once again, good questions, and actually all somewhat related. You've probably heard of their homeland. Today, we call it Tuscany. Fun fact, that name which we use today is based on what the Romans called them. They called themselves Ricenna or Rasna. Their territory used to be larger than Tuscany alone. In antiquity, the Etruscans controlled much of northern and northwestern Italy, especially the provinces known as Tuscany and Umbria today. That branch of the Mediterranean Sea between Italy and the islands of Sardinia and Corsica to the west is today called the Tyrrhenian Sea. Tyrrhenoi is the ancient Greek name for the Etruscans. So the Tyrrhenian can be translated as Etruscan Sea. Their homeland stopped at the Tiber River, south of which was the territory of the Latin people. Now, I must say that this is their homeland according to some sources. Although no ancient authors dispute that the Etruscans were in Italy before the Romans were, there was a fierce debate, even in antiquity, about the origins of the Etruscan people. This is because the Etruscans were strikingly different from other people of ancient Italy. And so the issue of where they came from and who they were related to was a subject of some discussion then and ever since. This is one of the great mysteries about the Etruscans. The two major sources and opposing positions that squared off in ancient times are the Greek historians, Dionysius of Halicarnassus and Herodotus, also from Halicarnassus, in what is today Western Turkey. Herodotus argued in about 430 BC that the Etruscans were immigrants into Italy just like the Greeks and the Romans were. In his story, they came from Lydia in Western Asia Minor, modern Turkey, as a result of a prolonged famine. In the words of Herodotus, still the affliction continued and even became worse. So the king determined to divide the nation in half and to make the two portions draw lots, the one to stay, the other to leave the land. He would continue to reign over those whose lot it should be to remain behind. The emigrants should have his son, Tyrrhenus, for their leader. The lot was cast, and they who had to emigrate went down to Smyrna and built themselves ships, in which, after they'd put on board all needful stores, they sailed away in search of new homes and better sustenance. After sailing past many countries, they came to Umbria, where they built cities for themselves and fixed their residence. Their former name of Lydians they laid aside and called themselves after the name of the king's son who led the colony, Tyrrhenians. Well, this is a rather standard origin story, explaining in a single event both where a people originated from and their odd name. You might be more familiar with the very, very similar story of Roman immigration from Asia Minor under Aeneas, and how they named their city after its founder, Romulus. Well, about 400 years after Herodotus, another Greek historian, Dionysius of Halicarnassus, came to the opposite conclusion. He argued that the Etruscans were, and I love this term, autochthonous. Literally, it means coming out of the ground, and it refers to people or cultures who sprang up in a particular place. Lots of people in antiquity claimed to be autochthonous because it gave them greater claim to a specific geographical location or a larger related area. For example, the Egyptians believed that they were created out of the mud of the Nile. The Athenians stated that their first king crawled out of a crack in the rock of the Acropolis. Each is a classic account of autochthonous people. Dionysius, however, used evidence provided by Etruscan culture to make his case. He said, "I do not believe either that the Tyrrhenians were a colony of the Lydians, for they do not use the same language as the latter, nor can it be alleged that, though they no longer speak a similar tongue, they still retain some other indications of their mother country, for they neither worship the same gods as the Lydians, nor make use of similar laws or institutions. Indeed, those probably come nearest to the truth who declare that the nation migrated from nowhere else but was native to the country, since it is found to be a very ancient nation and to agree with no other, either in its language or in its manner of living." Dionysius makes some very good points. The cultural elements that he lists, religion, language, laws, and institutions, by which he means government, are among the most conservative components of societies, and ones that change very, very slowly, even today. If he actually examined these, as he claims to have in another passage, then this is a solid approach to cultural analysis. Etruscan culture, especially religion, has many unique features, especially compared to other contemporary cultures. For instance, we'll examine that his point about language has been expanded to the conclusion that the Etruscan language is virtually unique in the world, and certainly unrelated to the languages of Eastern Mediterranean cultures, among them the Indo-European language family that includes Greek and Latin, and the Semitic group that includes Hebrew, Egyptian, Phoenician, and Arabic, among others. But not all Etruscan culture is unique, and nor has that stopped the debate. Some modern scholars support Herodotus' emigration argument with further evidence. For example, they compare the Etruscans' characteristic pointed shoes, as depicted in art from the 6th and 5th centuries BC, to very similar shoes seen in art from the same period in Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. While it's true that the shoes in these two cultures have virtually identical pointed toes, that seems to be a pretty weak basis for saying one culture is related to the other, let alone that one is an offshoot of the other. While acknowledging the parallel, I can't think of any other cultures whose connections are based largely or almost entirely on their footwear choices. Naturally, it would be impossible for any culture to be completely unique. The ancient Egyptians, for example, are known for their pyramids, but other cultures, notably in Mesoamerica, developed their own pyramid traditions independently. Sure, people argue for connections between the two, but all authorities agree that they're wrong. And we have argued the question of Etruscan origins for 2,500 years. And finally, we might have an answer, provided neither by ancient testimony nor by, it pains me to say, archaeology, but by modern science. DNA evidence supports the conclusion of Dionysius. So, Dionysius 1, Herodotus and pointy-toed shoes 0. Mitochondrial DNA analysis, based on samples taken from remains excavated in Italy and Asia Minor, concludes that the Etruscans are not related to the people of Central Asia Minor. Their DNA shows no particular affinity with the ancient Lydians. The close correspondence between Etruscan and Central and Southern European Neolithic mitochondrial DNA is a good argument for genetic continuity. Not that science is in complete agreement. Another DNA study of cattle remains from Italy found a strong affinity between them and breeds from Asia Minor. The authors of that study cleverly argued that the origins of the cattle should reflect the origins of the people. Very creative. But of course, there's no reason to believe that these cattle and the people in the same area had to have a common origin, nor that they came into the area at the same time. I give greater weight to the human DNA studies. Well, putting together the archaeology and DNA studies, we have a picture of development in the Etruscan civilization. After the Bronze Age cultural collapse that affected the entire Mediterranean basin in about 1300 BC, the so-called Villanovan culture arose. This was an early Iron Age culture named by modern archaeologists from the type site at Villanova. It's a small site about 5 miles from Bologna in northern Italy. It's essentially the early Iron Age phase of Etruscan civilization. We date Etruscan civilization itself as starting in 800 BC, because that's when the characteristic features of, among others, burial practices and pottery that are found in later centuries across Etruscan sites emerge. Why Etruscan culture appeared at this historic moment is actually a more interesting question than it might first seem. Intriguingly, the date is very close to that of the founding of Carthage in 810 BC, to the founding of Rome, traditionally placed in 753 BC, and the establishment of the Olympic Games in 776 BC, and of Greek colonies in Italy, beginning on the island of Ischia in about 800 BC. This is a remarkable period of cultural establishment, colonial expansion, and city foundation. Now, we might account for this in a number of ways. I think, however, that we cannot rule out competition and cultural connections as instigators of much of this dramatic change. Certainly, the founding of Greek colonies relied on trading interests with the native inhabitants of Italy, including the Etruscans. The founding of Rome itself, immediately across the border from Etruscan territory, seems a parallel situation. I conjecture that the contact between all of these civilizations is what caused the jump start in their cultures. We can, and will, trace the Greek and Near Eastern elements the Etruscans absorbed into their culture in later lectures. For now, a brief survey of contact and its history will suffice. Much of Etruscan culture was based at cities such as Bologna, Siena, Florence, and Orvieto, all of which are still occupied. In many ways, their political organization was very similar to that of contemporary Greeks. Unlike the Romans, who gradually developed a centrally controlled empire, the Etruscan cities were all city-states. That is, like the Greeks, each city and its surrounding territory comprised a sovereign state. They were only loosely banded together into leagues, which existed primarily for mutual defense, again, as seen in the ancient Greek world. The the Etruscan federations of states spread as they founded new colonies. Initially, what we call the Etruscan Federation or Etruscan League was made up of 12 city-states in Etruria, that core in modern Tuscany and Umbria. A Campanian League or federation was founded from their colonies in the south, and a third league from their cities in the Po River Valley in the north. They also had a thriving maritime culture and many coastal harbors on the west coast of Italy. From their colonies in what we call today southern Italy and Sicily, the Greeks crossed the Tyrrhenian Sea, often for trade and war. So did the Phoenicians from their cities in North Africa, Spain, and the islands of the central Mediterranean. But if the Etruscans lived in northern Italy, the Greeks in southern Italy and Sicily, and the Phoenicians even farther away, how did they make such strong connections to other cultures? The answer is invasion and colonization, or in other words, in ways that today would lead the United Nations to pass resolutions against them. The Etruscans, like the other expansionist cultures of the ancient Mediterranean, such as the Romans, Greeks, Phoenicians, and Egyptians, spread out across their traditional borders and colonized foreign territory. Like those other cultures, well, not the Egyptians, they were attracted to the land of southern Italy and competed against the Greeks, Phoenicians, and other Italic people, that is, more recent immigrants into the peninsula, to control and occupy that territory. It makes sense. The area of Campania, anchored by the Bay of Naples, is the breadbasket of ancient Italy, with vast grain fields. In the Bay of Naples are two of the best natural harbors in Italy, and thanks to the volcanic soil of the region, it's almost unbelievably fertile. Ancient sources testify to it producing two crops a year rather than the usual one. So once the Greeks and Phoenicians began their occupations, the Etruscans responded almost immediately. Not to overburden you with details, but a few examples will show just how intense and long-lasting this competition was. For instance, the Greeks founded their first colony in about 775 BC on the Italian mainland at Cumae on the north side of the Bay of Naples. This was about 18 miles from their first colony on the island of Ischia, just offshore. Within 10 years, and some sources say 5, the Etruscans retaliated against the Greeks by founding their own colony at Capua, not 20 miles away, or about an hour's drive in today's traffic around Naples. And that pattern of colonial foundation and response continued for at least a couple hundred years. Along the shoreline, almost in the center of the Bay of Naples, the Etruscans founded the city of Pompeii in about 600 BC. And shortly afterwards, or actually perhaps before, honestly, you'd think someone would have written that down, we think the Greeks founded their colony at Herculaneum in response. Finally, further south in Campania, about 50 miles south of Pompeii, is a small river called the Sele. On the north side of the river, the Etruscans dominated, while on the south side, the Greeks founded the colony of Paestum in about 600 BC. 600 BC seems to have been a very active time in terms of colonization between these two powers. What's more, the Greeks built a sanctuary right on the south bank of the Sele River with large-scale architectural sculpture. Typically, the subjects of the sculptures were Greek myth. But here, the themes were all the same. Don't mess with the Greeks. Every scene showed what happened to someone in Greek mythology who challenged the Greeks or their gods, and they included the sack of Troy, the labors of Hercules, and the punishments of sinners in the Greek underworld. Many scholars think that these images were created for the primary audience of the Etruscans across the river. This may exemplify one of the mechanisms by which Etruscans were introduced to Greek myths and art. Another less intuitive means of exposure to Greek culture is warfare. We'll look later at the wars between the Etruscans and Greeks, and then between the Etruscans and Romans. But suffice it to say for now that the Etruscans and Greeks went to war almost immediately and repeatedly to control the rich farmland of Campania and Capua and Cumae. They competed for regional dominance for more than 500 years. They fought major battles in the 6th, 5th, 4th, and 3rd centuries that drew in all of the civilizations of the central Mediterranean basin, including the Phoenicians and Greeks from as far away as Athens. It's an extraordinary record of belligerence, and I think no one but me, and now you, is aware of it. But it shaped the ancient world, and by extension, our own, in a number of ways. For the Etruscans, the struggle to expand and to gain control over ancient Italy led to competition, conflict, and direct contact with foreign cultures that spurred Etruscan growth, and also change within their own communities. This process was not only how the Etruscans transmitted their culture to the Romans, but it was also the initial conduit for Greek culture flowing into Rome. We don't have any firsthand testimony of this acceleration of cultural development from the Etruscans, but we have secondhand evidence and a very strong parallel. The secondhand evidence is in the dramatic changes that occurred in Etruscan culture. First, as they come into direct contact with Greeks, we see their art and religion most clearly absorb Greek concepts. Later, when the Etruscans are squeezed by territorial losses in the 3rd century BC, a strain of pessimism seems to overwhelm their art and their beliefs in the afterlife. Looking in the other direction, there's evidence that the Etruscans created the iconic monument at the site of Cumae, the Grotto of the Sibyl, the influential oracle of the Greek god Apollo. The Roman world of the late 3rd century BC provides a parallel for the mechanism of cultural change that occurred with the Etruscans. After the Roman general Marcus Claudius Marcellus sacked the Greek city of Syracuse in 212 BC, he celebrated an unprecedented triumphal procession. This otherwise characteristic Roman victory parade differed from any that came before. In this instance, Marcellus didn't just loot precious metals, slaves, and goods that could be used or sold. He had his men bring back Greek art, paintings, statues, even entire temples they disassembled, shipped, and reassembled in Rome. The result was to introduce Greek art to the public of Rome in large amounts for the very first time. It changed the shape of the city and Roman culture forever. War was a catalyst for cultural change. That's the model that seems to be operating in the Etruscan world as well. Well, speaking of the Romans, this is a good time to complete our timeline of war and mayhem and to enumerate some of the major Roman and Etruscan conflicts. Rome came somewhat late to the party with the Etruscans, but quickly made up for lost time. Rome itself was built on the south bank of the Tiber, just across from Etruscan territory. Rather predictably, the Etruscans opposed this new city at the edge of their sphere of influence and did their best to thwart Rome's growth. According to their own foundation myths, the Romans' wars with the Etruscans began early, with skirmishes commencing immediately following the establishment of Rome in 753 BC. Major wars took place at least from 509 BC to 290 BC. And after the occupation of Etruria in the 3rd century, the Etruscans seem to have repeatedly joined with Rome's enemies in attempts to overthrow Rome, with some uprisings taking place as late as the 1st century BC. This resulted in the final pacification of central Italy by the Romans. So what happened to the Etruscans? Where are they? Remarkably, in many ways, they didn't go anywhere. Certainly, they didn't just go away with the Roman conquest of their territory. The Romans didn't depopulate the cities. So the people in them who survived the wars were still there, conducting their daily lives largely as they had before. Roman rule made little practical difference initially to the average Etruscan. Rather, the Romans very likely became more Etruscan-like as they saw the houses, art, sanctuaries, and cities of these newly captured people. The same pattern is described and better documented slightly later in Greece by the Roman poet Horace. "Graecia capta ferum victorem cepit," he wrote. Captive Greece captured her wild conqueror. The Etruscan people and culture survived at least the initial Roman conquest and were identifiable in Italy down to the first century BC. Intriguingly, evidence suggests that in some ways the Etruscans are still very much with us, at least genetically. They certainly are culturally. This culture, which dominated central Italy for 500 years, conducted trade, war, and diplomacy with the Greeks and Phoenicians, and stood up to the power of Rome for hundreds of years, can give us clues to the origins of many of our own cultural traditions, even many of the very foundations of Western civilization.